Two views on clean power today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump moves to roll back Obama's clean power plan, and this Pennsylvania coal miner approves.
I've never once bought into the idea that global warming's causing ice to melt here, causing ice to melt there, and it's all because of coal.
But in New York, some say the days of coal and oil are over, no matter what the president says.
The compelling, obvious reasons why we should be supporting clean energy don't go away because Trump decides it's not a priority for him.
And in Nigeria, three girls who escaped Boko Haram try to stay positive.
I know one day our side will be fine and this Boko Haram issue will be over.
Those stories coming up today right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being here. It's been a bad few days for President Trump ever since his signature promise to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act went down in flames in Congress late last week. But today, the president tried to right the ship by keeping another promise to roll back many of President Obama's efforts to tackle climate change and remove restrictions on the use of high-carbon coal. Trump signed what he called the Energy Independence Executive Order.
Today, I'm taking bold action to follow through on that promise. My administration is putting an end to the war on coal.
We'll be going in depth on this hour. First, though, a debrief on the executive action from the World's Environment reporter Carolyn Beeler. Let's start with the basics, Carolyn. What does this executive order actually do?
Well, it seeks to be a sweeping reversal of Obama-era climate policies that really tried to bake climate change into the way the federal government operates. So a big change is that Trump is ordering an immediate reevaluation of the Clean Power Plan, which required states to cut carbon pollution from power plants by about a third by 2030. He also says he's going to lift the moratorium on new coal leases on federal lands. White House officials also say that the executive order is going to ask officials to reconsider the so-called social cost of carbon. Now, that's a dollar figure that's assigned to the negative impacts of climate change that federal agencies include sort of in the balance sheet when they're making calls about federal rules. It's also going to direct officials to re-examine the policy that climate change has to be taken into effect in environmental impact statements for all kinds of different federal projects.
Any sense of how long it'll take these changes to be enacted?
Some of them can happen with the stroke of a pen. So this reversal of the moratorium on coal leases on federal lands, that can happen, you know, basically overnight. The Clean Power Plan is a federal rule that went through a lengthy and arduous rulemaking process, and it's going to have to go through a similar process to be reversed.
For President Trump, this announcement is all about getting rid of so-called job-killing regulations. What do we know about how this will actually impact job creation in the U.S.?
There's no figure that the administration is citing for how many jobs this will create. Trump, in his announcement, did talk a lot about putting coal miners back to work. We do know that coal mining jobs have decreased drastically in the past couple of decades, but that's been due primarily to an increase in automation and an influx of cheap natural gas, not because of regulations. Today, there are about 50,000 jobs in coal mining right now. If you look at apples-to-apples figures, there are about double the amount of jobs in the solar industry as there are in the coal industry. And renewables are projected globally to grow a lot. Now, because of that, Christiana Figueres, the former head of the UN climate process, argues that this announcement isn't actually a job-creating move. It's actually a job-killing move.
By setting itself away from the path toward decarbonization, the U.S. is only making its economy less competitive, less exportable, and that means there are less domestic jobs.
And we'll be hearing more of the global perspective from Christiana Figueres later on the show. But, Carolyn, let's stick with domestic policy just a bit here. What is the reaction from the fossil fuel industry on the executive order?
They're pleased with this announcement, Marco. This is Trump keeping a major campaign promise.
So Trump signed this executive order surrounded by a group of coal miners. You spoke with some people in coal country about Trump's efforts to bring coal jobs back, and you heard some differing perspectives. So let's take a listen to that now.
In southwestern Pennsylvania, being a coal miner isn't just a job. It's something to be proud of.
America, it was all built by coal. My dad taught me that when I was just a young kid.
This is Tony Burnsack. He's been mining coal for 41 years, long enough to remember when it earned him some respect.
When I first started in the coal mines, that's the way it felt, is, you know, we was needed. Every time you turn a switch on, you know it come from you, or it come from my dad or my grandpap. That's where that power come from.
Burnsack knows that today, when a lot of Americans hear the word coal, they don't think reliable electricity. They think dirty air, pollution. He does not.
I've never once bought into the idea that coal-fired power plants were killing trees and were hurting the environment. The global warming is causing ice to melt here, causing ice to melt there. And it's all because of coal? I don't believe that for one minute.
For Burnsack and his wife, Sandy, the mountain of science proving the downsides of coal is irrelevant when weighed against what it's done for their family.
Oh, it's been everything. It's given us a, you know, home, sent our children to college. It's paid for, you know, my nieces and nephews to go to college.
Pictures of grandchildren now hang in the Burnsack's living room in Masontown, Pennsylvania. It's a two-stoplight borough near the West Virginia border. And over the past 8 years, every time the Obama administration wrote a new rule to cut coal pollution, Burnsack and his neighbors felt one step closer to getting laid off.
That's what everybody was scared, that they was going to lose their job. That's what it felt like every day, something new. I felt like it was attacking me personally, me and my family. They're trying to take food out of my mouth now.
A huge coal-fired power plant less than a mile from the Burnsacks shut down a couple of years ago. Local miners and their families feared they'd be the next to lose their jobs.
It's very stressful not knowing, you know, if they're going to have a job or not.
And we all feel that way. And that's why President Trump did so well in this area. I was ecstatic when he won, I'll be honest with you.
Burnsack believed President Trump would revive the coal industry. And so far, he's happy with what Trump's done. But even he is not so sure that the president can keep some of his sweeping promises. Like this one that Trump made shortly after the election.
I will cancel job-killing restrictions on the production of American energy, including shale energy and clean coal, creating many millions of high-paying jobs.
I really don't think that there's going to be that many more jobs created, but I do think it'll stabilize. As long as we got somebody like him, hopefully coal will stay around, and hopefully that mine that we work at. Them young boys are just starting out. They got 30 to 35 years in there.
But that kind of a future is likely something that even the president can't guarantee. Coal's in trouble around the world for a lot of reasons, and the Clean Power Plan never even went into effect before Trump pulled the plug. An influx of cheap natural gas has dealt the biggest blow to the coal industry. Wind and solar are also surging around the world.
Coal is just on its way out.
Nick Mullins was also a coal miner, fifth generation from southwestern Virginia.
And anything that we do to keep saying that coal is continuing or could come back and provide as many jobs as it once did is false.
Mullins worked in the mines in his 20s, but then moved his family to Kentucky for better schools and a cleaner environment. Unlike Burnsack, he does buy the downsides of coal. He knows it's responsible for big health and environmental problems.
To increase or boost coal mining in the region, that's only going to continue creating more problems. Mining damages the body and the land and the environment and people's water sources. So we don't need to be continuing something that has been so devastating to our people.
Every time he goes back home, Mullins sees more and more abandoned houses and overgrown yards. And he thinks Trump's promises will lock Appalachia into its downward spiral.
Whenever Trump says that he's going to bring coal jobs back, all that's doing is giving people a false hope and keeping people from working towards better alternatives to coal.
Alternatives like new jobs, cleaning up old mines, or developing tourism in Appalachia.
We need to be thinking and pushing the boundaries and finding a new source of our economics instead of just propping up one industry.
Propping up an industry, or from a different perspective, restoring coal to its rightful role in the American economy. However you see it, it probably won't happen quickly, as some of today's rule changes could be tied up in court for years. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Here's a campaign promise that President Trump is moving fast to deliver on: the wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. On the campaign trail, Trump boasted that nobody builds walls better than him and that he would do it inexpensively. But here's the reality. It'll be contractors who will do the job, and it's going to cost tens of billions of dollars. The bidding process for interested companies opened last week and closes tomorrow. The World's Monica Campbell has been following the story from Mexico City. So who's trying to get this gig? Mostly American companies?
Yeah, mostly American companies. So far, more than 700 companies have said they're interested in the wall. And they come from every state in the U.S. and a lot from California. And there's several dozen businesses that are actually owned by Latinos, surprisingly.
Is the U.S. government looking for anything specifically from bidders, as far as you know? Like, what are the parameters of this job?
So the government is taking two proposals for two different walls. So there's the request for a concrete wall, so something solid that you might think of when you think of a wall. The other is for something else, an alternative to concrete, so maybe something see-through. And beyond that, the instructions are that it's a minimum of 18 feet tall, that it can't be climbed, and that you can't dig under it or tunnel under it. And then there's that it needs to be, quote, aesthetically pleasing in color on the north side, the side facing the U.S. So it doesn't really matter what it looks like on the Mexico side, but on the U.S. side, the idea is that it's got to be pretty. I don't know, Marco. I can only imagine the type of graffiti we might see on the Mexico side.
Yeah. And who knew that contractors would now have to be submitting swatches to the U.S. government? Trump said Mexico would be paying for the wall, but Mexico's president, Enrique Peña Nieto, already said he will not pay for the wall. So ultimately, who will pay for it?
Well, I think it's still very much up in the air. I mean, we've heard Trump say that he's going to slap a border tax on Mexico, that he's going to tax remittances coming from the United States to Mexico. I mean, I think ultimately those are really going to be quite challenging. They involve Congress. We're going to see Congress need to approve a lot of the cost of this wall, which is in the billions and billions. I mean, we've heard some estimates that it's up to $25 billion. You know, we already know this is an unpopular proposal among many people in Congress and in the United States. And I think this is going to be one of those fights that Trump may not win.
Now, the reaction in Mexico to the wall has always been a mix of anger and you've got to be kidding me. Any change to that? Does that continue to be the tone?
Yeah, it's still the tone. I mean, even just recently, the Catholic Church here, the biggest archdiocese, said any Mexican company involved in the wall, they'd be considered traitors. Even the hint that a company would be involved triggered quite a bit of backlash here. We saw one example was Cemex, which is the largest cement maker in the world. It said that it would be open to providing the cement for the wall. That created a big backlash here in Mexico, and Cemex has backed off of even being a contender. But there's one company, one Mexican company has put in an official bid. It's the only one. And they import these huge lights from China, actually. And the guy, I talked to him, his name is Theodore Atala. He's actually from Egypt, but he's lived in Mexico for years. He says that it's going to benefit both Mexico and the U.S. So, for example, on the U.S. side, it'll prevent people from crossing into the United States illegally. But he said from the Mexico side, it'll prevent illegal guns from coming into the country and, you know, creating crime here. I expect that he's receiving some backlash from his friends and family, although he said, you know, so far people have kind of been, okay, you're a company owner and you're putting in a bid for something that's lucrative. But he sees this as business.
Trump's approval rating is down to a historic low, 36%. So what backlash are you seeing here in the U.S. to the wall? Is it taking a hit here as well?
I think any company that is involved in building this wall should be prepared for a backlash. And we're already seeing cities in California and in New York pressuring local officials to say, you know, we shouldn't have any business, any contracts with companies involved with the wall. So, I mean, it's going to be fierce. I think there could be some boycotts against companies, big and small, involved with the wall.
The World's Monica Campbell in Mexico City. Thank you, Monica.
Thanks, Marco.
Coming up, we meet a woman caught up in the battle for Mosul in Iraq and was injured, but still managed to escape the city and ISIS. That's next, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. The Iraqi city of Mosul is a key front in the war against ISIS. The Iraqi army, backed by a coalition led by the U.S., is pushing hard to retake the city from the militants. And as the fighting has escalated, so have civilian casualties. Today, the top American military commander in Iraq acknowledged that a U.S. airstrike was probably involved in an incident that killed a large number of civilians in Mosul. He also suggested ISIS was using civilians as human shields. The world's Richard Hall went to a hospital in nearby Erbil, where some of the injured from Mosul are being treated.
The hospital was full of casualties from western Mosul. Some of them were from airstrikes, and some of them were from ISIS snipers, some of them were from mortars. But the overall situation in western Mosul is clearly devastating for civilians at the moment.
You met one woman named Lina Shahab. Tell us what happened to her.
That's right. Lina was really in a terrible state when I found her. She was lying on a hospital bed. Her mother sat at the end of her bed. There wasn't really a part of her skin that wasn't marked by shrapnel wounds. She had lost the use of her right eye, really in a terrible state. And she was actually a victim of an airstrike that took place on March 17th. It's being called one of the worst casualty incidents caused by the US-led coalition in the campaign against ISIS since it began. She told me exactly what happened that day on March 17th.
Suddenly we heard a boom. I couldn't see anything. Glass went into my eye. A hole opened up in the floor and I fell through it. I saw everything burning. I saw my aunt and her kids dead on the other side of the room.
It's unbelievably terrible. Does her account suggest that ISIS was forcing civilians into particular buildings where they believe there will be shelling and bombing?
It does indeed. She told me in great detail about how ISIS fighters gathered up people in her neighborhood, by the dozen, in fact. They took dozens of people into this building where they were eventually hit. They herded them in there. They were actually moved once before they were hit from one building to another. And it seems as though ISIS is moving people into buildings that they're using as points to shoot at Iraqi troops from. So they are, in fact, using them as human shields, according to Lena's account anyway.
So Lena had these awful injuries, and yet she was still able to get out of West Mosul. Did she explain how she managed that?
She actually stayed for 4 days in Mosul after she was injured. She had these horrific injuries, and they were still trapped by the fighting. But after 4 days, the army finally broke through and took her to a hospital where there were some American field medics working. And then she was rushed to Erbil in an ambulance, and she's been recuperating there for the past few days.
Now, despite these horrific injuries, she's actually less worried, she told you, about herself than her family.
This is another tragic part of Lena's story. She's unaware where one of her children is. She said that she thinks two of her three children are safe, even though they were badly injured. But she said she didn't know where her third child was.
I have three kids. Two of them are full of shrapnel, but the other one, I don't know where he is. His name is Abdul Rahman. He is a big boy. If you look at him, you would think he is 18, but he is 12. We don't know anything about him. He is the most handsome of the three.
Yeah, that's just unreal. Did she lose other relatives?
She definitely saw her aunt and her sister-in-law killed at the exact moment of the explosion. She said she saw their bodies. Her husband, she thinks, is safe, but she's separated from her family. She just has her mother there at the moment.
The world's Richard Hall in Erbil, in Iraq. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Nelson Mandela, a great man, no doubt about that. But one thing about that greatness, it tended to overshadow some of the other leaders in South Africa's anti-apartheid movement, like Ahmed Kathrada. He was an Indian South African and a fellow member of the African National Congress with Mandela. Both men were jailed for 26 years by the apartheid regime. Both served much of that time on Robben Island. But as Kathrada once told the BBC, they were treated differently there because of their different backgrounds.
I got more sugar than Mandela. I got a little more meat, a little more fish than Mandela. I got a loaf of bread every day. Mandela got no bread. It was a microcosm of how apartheid applied in the whole country.
When Kathrada was released in 1989, he became President Mandela's political advisor. and then went on to dedicate his life to civil rights. Kathrada died this morning at the age of 87. My BBC colleague in Johannesburg, Milton Nkosi, joins us. How did Kathrada become involved in the anti-apartheid movement in the beginning?
So Ahmed Kathrada, at an early age, he started joining the anti-apartheid movement. He joined the Indian Congress and the Young Communist League, and eventually, as a young lad, he met with Mandela, and together they formed a team, and they were working very hard to fight the white minority regime.
Why were the struggles of black South Africans so important to him?
Because Ahmed Kathrada, under apartheid, he was still categorized as a black person, even though he was of Indian descent. So you've got to remember structurally the way apartheid worked. So at the top of the ladder were white people. At the second level, you had Indians. The third level, you had mixed race people known as coloreds. And at the bottom, we had black Africans. So Ahmed Kathrada found it completely unacceptable that Africans were treated as second-class citizens in their own country of birth.
Yeah, on that point, I mean, he said he dedicated his life to deracializing the anti-apartheid struggle. Can you explain what that means?
Because Indians had a semi-comfortable deal from the apartheid government, even though they were still below the whites, but they were above the coloreds and the blacks. And therefore, some Indians decided not to do anything about it because they had access to better schools, better parks, better public amenities, better health facilities. So there are some Indian people who decided just to toe the line, enjoy the privileges that they were given, and did not fight the struggle along black Africans. So what he did, he elevated the level of the struggle. He said, this is an injustice to all of us. Therefore, we will all join. We cannot leave it to the Africans who are at the bottom of the ladder. In other words, the Africans had now Indians amongst them. They had white people amongst them. And therefore, the struggle became a universal fight for human rights.
After he was released from prison, from Robben Island, he actually went back to Robben Island and was a tour guide.
That's correct. What Ahmed Kathrada decided to do to fight the demons of racial oppression, he decided that it would be spiritually cleansing for him if he kept on taking people who are visiting South Africa, especially prominent leaders, to Robben Island prison and tell them the story over and over again of what they experienced when they were prisoners. And one of his most prominent visitors was President Barack Obama, who was with his family there. And Ahmed Kathrada took him to his own cell. Wow. And I remember hearing him explain to President Obama that one of the things you miss when you are in prison is the sound of a baby. You long just to hear a voice of a baby, a crying baby. And President Obama was quite visibly moved by that anecdote.
My colleague Milton Nkosi, South Africa Bureau Chief for the BBC. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. President Trump says rolling back the Clean Power Plan will be good for jobs. One of the main architects of the Paris Climate Agreement says, not really.
The U.S. is only making its economy less competitive, less exportable, and that means there are less domestic jobs.
That story is just ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. President Trump signed an executive order today that's making coal miners and coal companies very happy. It reverses major Obama-era restrictions on greenhouse gas pollution from coal-fired power plants. Trump says the move fulfills his promise to revive the coal industry and the U.S. economy. But some critics say the move could actually be bad for the economy. Cristiana Figueres is a former head of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. In other words, she is the one who led nearly 200 countries to the landmark global climate change deal in Paris in 2015. Personally, what's your reaction to the Trump executive order today?
I'm actually deeply concerned for the U.S. economy. I'm not concerned for the rest of the world because the rest of the world will continue to move forward. We know that China, EU, Australia, Canada have already been very, very clear in saying that no matter what comes out of the United States, they will continue to move forward in decarbonizing their economy because it is good for their economy. We know that there are 7,000 cities around the world that will continue to move forward on climate change because they want to make their cities more livable. So this is about the economic imperative of clean technologies. By setting itself away from the path toward decarbonization, the U.S. is only making its economy less competitive. And that means with less competitiveness, there are less domestic jobs. So I am concerned for the U.S. economy.
I'm just curious, what did you think of Obama's Clean Power Plan when it was announced? Was it strong enough for the U.S.?
Well, I'm of the opinion, frankly, that no country is currently doing the best effort that they can and that they should.
Not a single one.
No, I don't think so. The more that we are inviting the ingenuity and the creativity of our men and women who are at the front of this technology, the quicker we're going to advance. The Clean Power Plan was actually a healthy policy, but it could have, in fact, even been stronger.
Yeah, so if Paris, the agreement was kind of intended to ramp up ambition and motivate society and innovators, is that at risk now?
No, definitely not at risk. This is a multilateral treaty that has already been ratified by 140 countries and counting, and it's definitely not at risk. One country can choose to park itself, if you will, on the sidelines of a highway that is very quickly taking us to a decarbonization. But just because one country chooses to park itself on the sidelines, it does not change the direction of travel of all the rest of the countries.
Do you think it'd be better for the U.S. to quit and just get out of the way, or is a potentially obstructionist U.S. better than no U.S. involvement in the U.N. climate process?
Well, bottom line, what they're really giving up on here is a huge economic opportunity. Bloomberg has just put out a report that action on climate change is going to add $19 trillion to the global economy. It is going to add 6 million jobs. So that growth and those jobs are going to go to those countries that are actually incentivizing the growth of clean technology. If the United States chooses to exit, they will not be partaking of this growth in economy, except, of course, in the cities and states and companies that will continue to move forward no matter what the White House says.
That's interesting because it is happening with local and state governments here in the U.S. and with private enterprise. But practically, how big of a deal is it that Washington is disengaging?
I frankly don't think that it is a big deal. I think it's a sad commentary on the fact that the administration does not seem to be in touch with reality, with a reality that is a global economy that is on an irreversible path toward decarbonizing itself and creating huge economic opportunities. So it really, more than anything, it denotes an ignorance of reality. But it is not derailing the process.
But you'd rather have the U.S. on board?
I would rather have all countries on board, obviously, and I would rather have them, you know, be more ambitious than less ambitious. It is just very, very sad that the U.S. is insisting on going back in technology. How would you consider any effort of any U.S. administration to shore up or to rescue a company called Kodak in a world of digital photography? It just makes no sense. If you really are looking at a strong economy in the near future, you want to make sure that you're preparing and anticipating for technological progress and not trying to swim against the stream of technological advance.
Cristiana Figueres was the executive secretary of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change from 2010 to 2016. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
So President Trump's trying to push coal and other legacy U.S. energy industries back to the forefront of the U.S. economy. But as Cristiana Figueres mentioned just now, much of the rest of the world and even some parts of the U.S. are moving in the other direction. Places like Buffalo, New York. Yep, Buffalo, which is bucking Washington, D.C., and betting big on renewable energy. Here's the world's Jason Margolis.
It's easy to pick on Buffalo. It's cold, it's snowy, the economy has been in the dumps for four decades, and the Bills lost four straight Super Bowls. Just saying. But around the turn of the 20th century, Buffalo was the place to be. It had the most millionaires per capita of any city in America. It hosted a World's Fair. It was a bustling inland port with hulking grain elevators and steel mills. One of the world's largest mills used to stand on the shores of Lake Erie. These days, all you hear is the wind roaring off the water. For Paul Curran, the managing director of BQ Energy, that's the sound of opportunity.
We're standing at the bottom of turbine number one. There are 14 turbines in all that generate 35 megawatts of electricity.
Curran's wind turbines supply power for about 10,000 homes.
Today it's a bit windy, which is good for business, with some showers off and on.
Curran walks off as the rain picks up when I come up with a brilliant suggestion.
Should we do the rest of the interview in the car?
Sure.
All right.
Driving around the 1,200-acre site, you see industrial ruins alongside wind turbines and rows of solar panels. It's something of a success story, repurposing toxic, polluted land in a way that's helping combat climate change. But it's not a job story.
There used to be something like 25,000 jobs on the land we're sitting on right now. Today, there's zero.
But projects like this could become a Buffalo job story. Right now, Curran buys many of his parts from overseas.
To the extent that they were made here in Buffalo, that would be great for us as a consumer of that type of equipment.
That's what the state of New York is betting on. It's trying to create a so-called cluster economy for clean technology.
You're more likely to grow in industries where you have a particular concentration because you have the skilled labor for that industry, because you have the supply chain for that industry.
Howard Zemsky is president of Empire State Development, the economic development agency for the state of New York. A few years back, New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo spearheaded the Buffalo Billion Initiative, pumping $1 billion into the area. Three-quarters of that total went toward a massive solar panel factory. It's expected to eventually generate about 5,000 jobs statewide. Critics argue that's a lot of public money for a few thousand solar jobs. And it's certainly not how President Trump thinks things should be going. He sees America's future in old-line industries, things like coal and oil. Zemsky isn't worried about that.
What President Trump decides to do or not do with respect to renewable energy will prove in history to be an asterisk or a bump in the road. The compelling, obvious compelling reasons why we should be supporting clean energy don't go away because Trump decides it's not a priority for him.
Those compelling reasons include booming global demand for green energy technology. The state isn't just betting on large-scale projects to achieve its goals. It's trying to lure entrepreneurs to Buffalo with an annual business plan competition that it dubs the largest in the world. It's called 43 North for the city's latitude, and it doles out $5 million in prizes annually. Daniel Cheney grabbed $500,000 for his startup, Energy Intelligence, a company designing a new way to generate electricity. He shows me a rendering of his product.
So what you see is a flat, wide mat that lays right on top of the road surface. And as vehicles drive over it, they're pushing pressurized fluid through embedded channels. So it's a hydraulic-based system to ultimately spin a generator.
Translation, the weight and motion of cars and trucks creates power. When Cheney won the prize money, there was a string attached. He had to relocate from Brooklyn to Buffalo for a year. He did, and has actually stayed on for another. He sold on Buffalo.
Tons of new development, lots of new bars and restaurants, and just a wonderful quality of life. And the cheap rent is nice compared to New York City.
I have to ask how much you pay now.
Well, I mean, let's just say it's less than half of what I'm paying in Brooklyn.
Cheney and other prize winners share a rent-free, open-plan workspace downtown. The idea is to get a bunch of smart people in the same room sharing coffee and ideas. The boosters are rightly proud of the buzz in Buffalo. Cynics say, let's not get too carried away. Buffalo is still America's third poorest big city. Robert Shibley, dean of the School of Architecture and Planning at the University at Buffalo, says the city can't sugarcoat things. But the data shows they're moving in the right direction. Buffalo has had more than 3 years of steady job growth.
Not since World War II have we seen that. So that's something to be really positive about. We see number of firms, number of employees, wages all ticking up for the first time in decades.
Shibley says advanced manufacturing is helping to fuel that growth, and green energy is very much part of the new matrix. For The World, Jason Margolis, Buffalo.
A new law went into effect in Hungary today, a law that, according to critics, is essentially an abuse of human rights. Starting today, asylum seekers arriving in Hungary will be detained at border camps made up of converted shipping containers. Most of the migrants are fleeing war or poverty in the Middle East, Southeast Asia, and Africa. Reporter Jean Carstensen has been speaking with migrants in the camp. Jean joins us on Skype from a restaurant in the town of Subotica near the Hungary-Serbia border. So what do these camps actually look like, Jean?
They're a tight warren of containers, of metal containers, and they're heavily covered in coils of barbed wire. They're very unfriendly looking camps. I have not been inside one. Media is not allowed in.
You've been speaking with refugees and hearing their take on this camp with these shipping containers. What have you been hearing?
Well, I spoke with one woman last night, a veterinarian from Iraq. She's a Kurdish woman, and she told me her thoughts about having to move into this detention center with her husband and two children.
Yeah, if you want a camp, yes, at least that's safe for the children.
No problem, but a good place. Not like you see the, what, this box, like container? How we live there? How we sleep there? The baby, if sick, what do we do there? Everything problem here.
Jean, is Hungary essentially telling these refugees, if you want to come to Hungary, this is where you're going to be staying for a while?
Yeah, that's exactly what they're saying. And the impact of this is very large. Earlier today, I was in an official Serbian refugee camp. I spoke with Safet there. He is the camp manager. And he was saying he's afraid of the impacts. People are getting discouraged. And he thinks over time, with this kind of very negative law in Hungary, that we could see a lot of tension among this population that's waiting in Serbia.
We are scared that this new law and new rule in Hungary and European Union will be a huge open gate for smugglers and people who are doing trafficking.
Yeah, so why is the Hungarian government dealing with refugees this way?
Well, they do not want refugees inside their country. And also, they say that they're just fulfilling their mandate as part of the European Union to close the borders, protect the borders. And they say that they're offering a legal process. But I think this is very much in question right now, whether this is a legal process or not.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is that Hungary is trying to make conditions so unwelcoming that refugees will think twice before going there. And I guess my question is, isn't that a violation of EU law and the Refugee Convention?
Many human rights organizations have come together and they've written letters to the European Commission saying that, yes, it's in violation of EU law and the Refugee Convention. And there's two main issues here. You know, one is summary deportation of asylum seekers back to Serbia without allowing them access to a Hungarian asylum system, that is a violation. And that just detaining people automatically before their cases are heard is also a violation.
And with Hungary being an EU member state and the EU being in such disarray right now, what can they do to pressure Hungary and enforce free migration?
Well, this is an open question. The Minister of Migration for the EU is in Hungary today, in fact, and he issued a statement in which he praised Hungary's actions and participation in border safety for the European Union. The statement seemed to vaguely raise some concerns and said that they will want to continue discussions with Hungary to make sure that they're in compliance. But so far, the European Union, the EU Commission, has really not done very much to pressure Hungary in spite of a lot of outcry from human rights organizations.
Jean Carstensen speaking with us from the Hungary-Serbia border, where migrants are being detained under a new Hungarian law. Jean, thanks very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you, Marco.
Jean's coverage of the migrant crisis in Europe is supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. We've heard a lot about the Chibok girls, more than 270 students kidnapped from their school in Chibok, northern Nigeria, by the extremist group Boko Haram. Their abduction in 2014 got massive attention from the Western media, for better or for worse. Most of the Chibok girls are still missing. A handful have been freed and, as we've reported, struggle to deal with the notoriety. And then there are those who escaped right after their abduction. That's the case with three girls named Mary, Glory, and Lottie. They jumped off a truck that night, fled into the forest, and managed to return home to their families. Brenna Daldorf met up with Mary, Glory, and Lottie to find out what's happened to them in the past 3 years.
In the weeks following the attack, Mary felt empty. She was at home with her family, but she had witnessed her friends being kidnapped. Boko Haram still threatened the region, and she couldn't go back to school. Then something unexpected happened. The president of the American University of Nigeria was so moved by the girl's story, she decided to offer them a scholarship. Mary desperately wanted to go to school, but her grandfather said no. He was scared.
Everybody said that if you allow your children to go back to school, these people will kidnap them again.
Mary's grandfather had almost lost her once. He didn't think an education was worth losing her again. But her mother couldn't stop thinking about the offer. When she was Mary's age, she had wanted to go to school. Instead, she was married off at age 14. She didn't want that for her daughter.
And one day my mom said, allow this girl to go to school. I said, oh my gosh, I will go back to school. I was so happy.
In Lottie's house, things played out differently. Her father wanted her to go, but Lottie was traumatized by the attack, and she felt betrayed by her dad. One day she screamed at him, did you like what happened to me?
And my dad told me, no, I won't like anything to hurt you. You go to school, because if you are educated, you can help the community and change this thing that is happening. So you must go to school.
In the end, though, it was Lottie's friends who persuaded her to go. As for Glory, she was the only child in her family to get an education. And when the school in Chibok closed after the attack, her parents didn't have the money to send her anywhere else. So when the American University, or AUN, offered the full scholarship, she jumped at the opportunity. The first group of girls from Chibok arrived on the AUN campus in Yola on August 30th, 2014, but it was kept secret. So secret that even the assistant dean of student affairs, Reg Braggs, didn't know about it. That night, he got a call to come to the library. When he got there, he saw a group of university VIPs.
And I'm wondering, what are all these people doing here? And then that's when they told me what was going on. And I was like, wow.
Reg is American, by the way.
And then it got even more interesting when they were saying they wanted me to kind of organize this.
The girls were high school students. They weren't ready for university. They needed a special curriculum that Reg would have to develop.
There was no playbook to pull off the shelf and say, this is how you put together a program for students who just got away from a terrorist organization.
For the 24 Chibok girls, just adjusting to their new surroundings was a struggle. Chibok is a small village. They had never been to a big city like Yola. Mary says when she walked onto the AUN campus, with its sculpted lawns and gardens, state-of-the-art buildings, and air conditioning, she was overwhelmed. She thought,
oh my God, this is not Nigeria. Maybe it's another country.
But her dad gave her a pep talk.
And I started crying. My dad said, no, you can make it. You say you want to go to school, right? You can do it.
It was a huge adjustment. Most of the girls spoke Hausa at home. Here, everyone spoke English. The food was different. The clothes were different. Glory says even the water they drank was a different color. Then there was school itself. The one the girls attended in Chibok wasn't so good. Glory says the teachers often didn't even show up, and the students would just sit in class, sewing and braiding each other's hair.
We don't know how to read. We don't know how to concentrate on our books. We don't used to do assignments.
At AUN, school is serious business. Even activities like talent shows and debate nights are meant to help the girls to develop public speaking and critical thinking skills. It's been 2.5 years since the girls first came to AUN. 6 have graduated and started university. 18 are still working their way through high school classes, including Mary, Glory, and Lottie. They're 17 now. They know they have an incredible opportunity and they aren't about to waste it. Sometimes Mary thinks about the girls who didn't get away. She tries to imagine what life is like for her former roommate and the girl she once sat in class with.
Some become a mother in age of maybe 15, 16, 17.
She prays they'll get an opportunity like she did. and some of them might. Last October, Boko Haram released 21 of the captive schoolgirls. Laddie remembers turning on the TV that day.
All of us are shouting, jumping, very excited. Everybody is happy.
Those girls are still in the custody of the Nigerian military. There are concerns that they may have been brainwashed by their captors and could pose a security threat. But if they do pass security clearance, Reg says there's a place for them at AUN's school.
The students that we have here in our program now, they know all of 21 of them. They know them personally. That's her. I know her. Oh, yeah. Yo, there she lives in my village. So this is really the best place for them to come, not to go to some obscure location where they may be scrutinized and, you know, you really have to be very sensitive to that type of thing.
After getting through the trauma themselves, the girls at AUN are full of advice. First off, Glory says, don't think about the past.
You should just start another new life fresh. If they are having difficulties, they should feel free to ask any of us. We are free to help them because we too, we did the same thing.
When Mary, Letty, and Glory go back to their village now, they're respected. People ask them for advice. Letty and Glory want to be doctors. Mary wants to be a lawyer. All of them want to make life better for people in Chibok. The key is education, says Mary.
When I go back to my community, I can encourage them the way people encourage me. I know one day our side will be fine and this Boko Haram issue will be over.
The name Boko Haram means Western education is forbidden. So it's a terrible irony that the attack on Chibok led to unimaginable opportunities for some of its survivors. It also turned these girls into passionate advocates for the value of education. As Glory says,
today we are in school. Tomorrow we are going to be better to change everything that is happening in our community.
For The World, Brenna Daldorf, Yola, Nigeria.
Those girls have powers they might not even realize yet. And dropping later this week, musical girl power from Africa. Les Amazones d'Afrique is a recently formed collective of 10 fierce women vocalists from West Africa. Some are veterans like Angélique Kidjo from Benin and Mali's Kanja Kouyaté. But this is up-and-coming Nigerian singer Nneka. As we walk with love. Cause when things go wrong, we still be strong. New music there, available later this week from Nneka and Les Amazones d'Afrique. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow. Tell me one more way you're heading to with your baggage. Oh, this one, my you won't listen, don't see your baggage. Cause when things are hard, you must walk right.
PRI, Public Radio International.